This morning in this first hour of the show, the topic is women's health, something that we do every month on the show with our regular guest on the subject, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice here in the area. She also teaches at U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign and does these programs with us once a month and has been for doing this for quite a long time now. Questions are welcome. She usually comes prepared with a few things to talk about. And if people have questions on those subjects, you're certainly welcome to call. But it can be anything else as long as it falls within her area of practice. We talk about a lot of different things on this program over the years. So if you have questions about women's health, you can call us, and I know that she will do her best to give you an answer. Do keep in mind that I also like to try to mention when we have doctors on the show that we can't do diagnosis over the telephone. There are some limits as to what we can do, but we do these shows to help add to your health knowledge. It might be a place to start. You could ask some basic questions, and then if you have concerns about your health or the health of someone in your family, you should take that up with your own physician or someone who can see you. But this is certainly one place to gather some information. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you are here where we are, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. And that's good any place that you can hear us. Around Illinois and Indiana, if you're listening, and it would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. Also, in fact, if someone would happen to be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. So again, here, locally, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Well, what would you like to start with, to talk about?
Well, yeah, I know a lot of the callers are even medical professionals because sometimes I run into them and they ask me a couple of follow-up questions. And over the weekend, I found a very good internet site that I thought I would talk about a tiny bit. It's on breast cancer. It is a commercial site. You always ask me that, so I start with that.
Oh, I don't always ask.
And it's called breastcancerprofessional.com, but they actually have quite a bit of a very good patient information. It is a site by AstraZeneca, who is the maker of tamoxifen, which is a medication that women can take to reduce their chances of breast cancer. They also make some breast cancer treatments. They have some slide sets that you can log on and look at, and they have actually excellent pictures of breast mammography. They have excellent pictures of MRIs. They have some good information about the benefits of mammography and the difference between a screening mammogram and a diagnostic mammogram. A lot of the kinds of things that we talk about, they have a pretty good section for nurses to answer patient questions. They actually have sections for office managers where you can get into a informational area about getting your visits paid for and your medications paid for and your cancer treatments and diagnoses paid for properly with your type of insurance. And that I thought was really helpful. I thought also under the segment for clinical trials, a lot of patients do ask us where they can look up clinical trials. And of course, when I'm on the show, I talk about ones that I'm directly involved with, but they have references to the National Institute of Health, the NIH trial sites. They have references to two good sites, one called CenterWatch and one called Clinical Trials. And I think it's probably CenterWatch.com and ClinicalTrials.com, but they have the actual website addresses there for you. And those have very good national directories of what clinical trials are going on. I think the FDA has a site where you can get information about participating in clinical trials, either for cancer or for other reasons. So I thought it was a very good resource. I especially like the pictures. And myself, I use those in talks. So I thought I would talk about that site. It's breastcancerprofessional.com, and it's a good site.
Is there anything new on the subject of mammogram?
Well, they pretty much have still shown time and time again that mammograms do save lives, and that if you pick up breast cancer in the early stage, that 97% to 98% of women will survive their breast cancer, whereas breast cancers picked up later than that, don't have as good survival rate. And I think some of that information still does get confused. I was talking to a patient not very long ago who said that, well, since she read that many breast cancers are found by patients themselves, she thought by doing a good breast exam, she was doing what she needed to do to survey herself for breast cancer. But still, mammograms can find breast cancers before we can actually feel them, and they have only a false negative rate of about 3%. And the newest information is that MRIs, the magnetic resonance imaging that's not done with radiation but with magnetism, probably does have a higher pickup rate, but it's still problematic to use that as screening. And with that MRI test, you get more images that you don't know what to do with. And I read one article where they were calling them UBOs, unidentified bright objects. So you get a lot of spots that they're just not sure about. So the one of the problems with MRIs is, number one, they don't have enough machines. There's probably not enough capability in the United States to just do every woman's routine screening mammogram on MRIs. But number two, it's a very expensive test. And number three, they need to come up with a specific plan of how we're going to follow patients. We can't then turn around and do biopsies on virtually everybody that has an MRI, and it wouldn't be that bad. But we would have to deal with many additional biopsies. And getting called back for your mammogram is something that patients really do like to avoid. There are some studies that show that if you have your mammogram done digitally, that there's fewer callbacks. And the mammogram itself is an X-ray. And whether you then take the information the machine gets and print that out on a standard X-ray film, which is it's one of these dark films, it's got silver, it's like a photographic plate, or actually just have the information go into a computer and have the entire picture generated by a computer. The test itself is virtually identical. So the question is whether or not you benefit by having the image processed done differently. And I think there is some evidence that that is a better test. There's certainly a lot of capabilities of what somebody can do with a digital image. Actually, Carl has a new system for processing their digital images that I was training on a few days back. And when you get a CAT scan or a chest X-ray or an ultrasound, your doctor can log on to this image viewer and you can scroll through it and you can flip the images and you can put on measures or mark the spot, and it's really quite fancy. Mm-hmm. Their mammograms aren't on that system yet, and their other radiologic studies have only been on since February, but I was very impressed.
We have a caller here, and just let me ask you one other quick question, because it is something that I feel like I continue to hear from time to time people raising questions, and because as you say, the mammogram is an X-ray, and I think that there continue to be people who say, is there any potential risk, any potential health risk? Could, in fact, mammogram do anything to increase a woman's risk of developing breast cancer?
Well, a mammogram does expose you to some radiation. And there would be some question that if you started your mammograms very, very early in life and continued practically yearly or every few years when you're young and then yearly after age 40, would that cumulative radiation be so great as to change your risk of getting some cancer? And we also have to preface that with saying that we all are exposed to radiation. Walking outside exposes you to radiation. And of course, then there are other ways that we get exposed to radiation. And when they've done very, very large study calculations, it is theoretically possible somebody would have a cancer induced by all those tests, but it's so uncommon and it raises your relative risk by so little. And the flip side is so many people saving lives who get the mammograms that it's really not a consideration that we tell patients to worry about.
All right. Our guest this morning, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on the program once a month. We talk about women's health, and your questions are welcome. We have a couple of here ready to go. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. And if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. The first caller is on the toll-free line in Wellington, and this is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I have a question about the disparity in the price. Maybe you can shed some light on this, between regular mammograms and the digital ones. Last year, while I went and got my mammogram at the same location, which is a major medical center, and you know, when they came in, they said they had both last year, and it was kind of like, well, whoever's free, you just got that one. And I ended up getting a digital one. Well, when I got the bill, I about died of shock because it was about 3 times as expensive. And I was just curious as to, you know, what makes the disparity in the price.
Well, it's a great question, and it's something that's bothered me quite a bit. The digital machines are much more expensive than the other. Oh, hello?
I can the caller hear us? Can you hear us now?
Hello?
Okay.
I know that we can hear the caller. For some reason, she can't hear us. We'll see if we can get that straightened out.
Well, you can just answer on the radio on that.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Very good.
Hopefully, we're still on the radio. But
Go ahead.
So the digital machine itself is extraordinarily expensive. Now, whether or not that, and so certainly some of the price factor has to be factoring in the payment for the machine itself. And exactly how they factor that in and how fast they want to get paid off for those machines must reflect the price. Whether or not the radiologist actually charges more, I need to find that out myself, because I'm trying to negotiate funding for some of my research studies and getting mammograms paid for, and I discovered that I discovered the same thing that the caller discovered, the discrepancy in prices. Now, some insurance companies will just charge you your same copay and won't charge you a lot extra for the copay. But I think it's strictly because the machines are so expensive. But there is always hope with that, because I'm just purchasing a new ultrasound machine. And although from the first ultrasound machine that I got, there was a 10 times inflation to the last ultrasound machine that I got over many, many, many years. But then this ultrasound machine was maybe a fifth, and it has more capabilities. Mm-hmm. So now that there's been really an explosion of that technology and lots of machines being sold, that the price of the machines has come down significantly. And that may have a trickle-down effect on the price of ultrasounds as well, although most of those have actually been held down fairly well.
Yeah. Well, I know that there are a lot of dental offices that are converting to the digital X-ray.
Mm-hmm.
Would you expect that over time, that's just the way that it's going to be, that they'll get to
a time
where the old-fashioned ones where you hold that they'll hold that thing up to the lighted screen.
They won't sell those machines.
You don't look that. They won't do that anymore.
Correct.
Yeah, all right. Let's continue. We have another caller here in Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I just started on Actonel, which is one of the bisphosphonates, I believe.
Yes.
And it differs slightly in chemical composition from Fosamax, but does something similar. I was visiting with a family member who's been taking Fosamax for a while, and she said, what's the difference between Fosamax and Actonel? So I went looking for more information online and didn't get far enough in the reams of different websites to figure out what the difference to me versus her was, as opposed to the chemical company's bottom line. But I ran across one troubling website which included somebody's personal comments, and so I don't know whether she knew what she was talking about or not, but she was saying that both of these chemicals kill off, which bothered me. That sounded to me like she maybe was changing the wording. The osteoclasts, the cells that break down bone to release bone calcium into the bloodstream, and that they replace some of the missing calcium from your bone with another chemical, and it wasn't clear whether this secondary chemical, which isn't a normal part of your bones, whether that was actually equal in strength to normal bone. Can you talk about what actually happens in bones, and what does one do to... the other part of our discussion was my doctor said you should get at least 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day in addition to taking this once-a-week pill. And my sister-in-law said, oh, I don't drink much milk in the summertime. It's too hot. So would you talk about some of those issues if you can?
Okay. You're asking a lot of fabulous questions, and I see that I have other colors, and some of it's quite technical. Fosamax and actinol are both bisphosphonates. They are chemically quite different. Fosamax has a much longer half-life than actinol. The studies that were done were not directly comparative. In other words, no one has done a study which had Fosamax, actinol. Now the new one that is out, Beneva, that patients can take once a month, you really have to just look at their placebo groups and see if these groups are somewhat comparative. For most patients, Beneva is a little bit more expensive. It's so new, it's not on the formulary. The company will give you some coupons to try to get it its price in line with actinol and Fosamax. For most of my patients clinically, if they tolerate both medicines equally, there's probably not a lot of conflicting evidence that says you couldn't flip from one to the other. So that formulary drives a lot of my personal prescriptions, and I think that's true for many physicians. It is true to have healthy bones. Bones are our depository of calcium. So we need calcium for lots of things, for brain power, for heart power, for muscle power. And we take calcium into our diet. It gets absorbed up through the GI tract, gets deposited in bone. That deposit system is a little bit slower because we don't want to just suck all the calcium out of our bone and put it out of our bloodstream and put it in our bone. And then we need to be able to mobilize calcium. We need to be able to put that calcium back in the bloodstream if, in fact, we need it. And so there is this this system where the bones continually get remodeled, but the hidden agenda behind that remodeling is the health of the bone, but also making calcium available for us when we need it and where we need it. And most medicines on the market to preserve bone thickness, like the bisphosphonates, like estrogen, like calcitonin, even Avista, the CIRM, what they do is they do slow down bone turnover so that the wearing away process is a little bit slower. And that's what she's talking about with the osteoclasts. Now, whether or not it actually kills off osteoclasts, that I'm going to have to defer to check in my books again, because I don't... osteoclasts and osteoblasts are formed a little bit differently, so you wouldn't have as many activated osteoclasts. But then the osteoblasts, which deposit bone, that is something that then has parathyroid hormone does affect that and gives us extra bones, but the bisphosphonates do not. So it is a different mechanism of preserving our bone thickness, but ultimately what's most important is, have we slowed bone turnover down to premenopausal levels? Have we improved the function and structure of our bones such that we have better bones and fewer fractures? And actually, actinol has done some very elegant studies showing the bone architecture really significantly improving, and that's an area of research they've been very active with. But Fosamax definitely is, it is a very good drug, and yet both. If you read the package inserts on all these bisphosphonates, gets back to what you were saying about calcium, is you do need a certain amount of calcium in your bone. And if you, and those drugs are contraindicated if either your blood calcium level's poor or your dietary intake of calcium is poor. And I keep harping on vitamin D. You can't really get that calcium out of your GI tract without that vitamin D. So you need the vitamin D as well. It doesn't always have to be in milk that we get calcium or vitamin D. There are many other sources, but if you're on these medications, it probably is important to have some blood studies at some point down the line and some discussion with your healthcare provider to make sure you're both on the same page as to how much calcium you need.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. And just to mention one other thing you talked about in building bone, you got to have your calcium, you got to have your vitamin D. You also have to have some weight-bearing exercise, right?
Absolutely. That is beneficial. Now, there's some, you know, being born with the right genes always helps. And there are some people, when they don't lift a feather and they've got perfect bones. But absolutely, weight-bearing exercise is important. And we say that's why one of the reasons astronauts wobble off the shuttles is because they've not been in gravity, and that's a problem. And so that the appropriate exercise, very important. Actually, even swimming has been shown to improve your bones. But we think that a very important component of all this is actually being monitored. So you get a physical exam to look at your posture and your spine, and you get a bone density to look at the thickness. And beyond that, depending on your case, you get blood studies of calcium, and you get a nutritional and exercise consultation, and sometimes even x-rays to determine whether or not you have fractures. This is another big area that I'm trying to get a little bit more up to speed on. You can use the bone density machines to look at whether or not you have very small fractures, and that's in our area not something that's really been done. It's kind of a new area, and most of us are still training on it, but that'll be probably the next thing. And with these medicines, many people are going to need medicines to prevent fractures. And exactly the right medicine for the right amount of time is very complex. And the route of medicine is important. We have a lot of patients that have already reflux disease or esophagitis. And sometimes taking the Actonel and Fosamax can be difficult, which is why the Beneva with once a month is really going to fill a niche in patients that don't want to take a once a week medication. And there are other types of routes of medication being looked at. We're participating in one of those studies that's probably just going to enroll for a couple more weeks, looking at an alternative to the Actonel and Fosamax.
We have come up a couple of other callers here. Dr. Suzanne Troopin is our guest. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice in our area. She teaches at the U of I Med School, and once a month, always on a Monday. Generally, it's the fourth Monday of the month. She is here, and we talk about women's health. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next, we have someone calling from Aurora on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered, in osteoarthritis, what can the patient do to mend the wear and tear that has occurred in the fingers?
I'm really not sure about that. I know that there are some treatments, and I know when the inflammation cuts down that there is some joint improvement, but it's beyond my field to really give you a thorough explanation of that.
Okay. My second question is, I heard recently that it was a possibility that they could keep cancer, breast cancer, from metastasizing to the rest of the body. Is that a fact, or is it still in the working?
Well, of course, the ideal scenario is, number one, to prevent it from occurring ever.
And how
there,
do you do that?
Well, breastfeeding helps. Exercising apparently helps. There was a new study looking retrospectively at statin use, the medication, statins, the medications that reduce your cholesterol. Retrospective studies showed a 50% reduction in breast cancer rates. Probably using the lower doses of hormone replacement therapy in only younger patients, that will decrease. So prevention is probably the first best strategy. Secondly is identification before the metastatic stage. And then lastly, when a cancer becomes big enough that it can metastasize, to have it identified and treated with medication so that metastases do not come to pass. So the medications that are used definitely are making inroads on those, but as a complete prevention, I don't know that we have that strategy yet.
Well, I heard it spoken about in the past month, but I haven't heard it again, and I just wondered where it was in the medical field, where, you know, at what stage it was.
It's always difficult to keep track of those media reports. There
yes,
are many.
Thank you, and I appreciate you being on the program very much.
Oh, thank you for the call. Let's go on. We have someone here in Marion County, I believe, in line number two. Hello.
Hi there. My doctor, my gynecologist, is having me tested, blood tests, and one of the tests is for the sex hormone binding globulin, and I was wondering what that would be testing for.
We make a compound in our liver called sex hormone binding globulin, and most of us just call it SHBG. And this SHBG carries substances around. It's a protein, but it carries substances around, and it binds many of our hormones, including our male hormone testosterone. And we think that even if we have elevated levels of certain hormones, like testosterone as an example, that if most of that testosterone is actually bound to the SHBG, it can't release from that molecule all that easily, and therefore it isn't as active. So that one of our strategies to reducing the effects of some of the unwanted effects of these hormones is to increase SHBG. So that molecule is actually responsible for a good part of the way that birth control pills work to control acne. So they have the birth control pills have estrogen. The estrogen affects the liver. The liver makes more SHBG. And so the testosterone that is in the body is bound. It isn't available to get converted to dihydrotestosterone and affect the skin, so you don't have as many pimples. And trying to figure out SHBG usually isn't done in isolation. It usually is done in the context of a workup with other hormone tests. But so I can't really answer exactly why that test would be ordered, but that's what the molecule's for.
It was more on menopausal estrogen levels is what she was testing other things for.
Well, again, I think probably this is something that you'll have to sit down with your provider and take a couple of steps back and find out what you're trying to treat and what you're trying to achieve. In menopause, we tend to not naturally have much estrogen. And so if we supplement patients with either estrogen or testosterone, it can have an effect on SHBG, but I'm not sure how you would use a blood level of SHBG to then modify exactly what you are giving the patient. We have a little bit of a disconnect. We have to have a little bit more information. It probably something you should talk individually with your doctor about.
Okay. And isn't magnesium especially important for bones also?
Magnesium is important for bones. Vitamin K is important for bones. Phosphorus is even important for bones. So there are many minerals that actually are important for overall bone health.
And I wanted to ask you if you knew, my sister-in-law is 9 years into having ovarian cancer, and she's gone through, I think, 5 different chemotherapies, and she's really found excellent relief now. Her counts are way down by using intravenous vitamin C. Are they doing that in other, this is out of a University of Kansas Medical Center. Is anyone in Illinois, are you aware of using this?
It's not a treatment that I'm actually aware of. It may be something that actual oncologists, doctors who specialize in the treatment of cancer have started to do. I know that we use intravenous routes of administration of medication more and more. There are iron therapies that are being tested. There are osteoporosis therapies that are being tested. There are many ways that we can use that route of administration to bypass some of the side effects that taking an oral medication may have. And so that may be, in fact, a new area of research. I use a lot of vitamin B injections in my pregnant patients. It's a good treatment for nausea. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't surprise me that somebody is using C, but it isn't something that I've ever used.
Well, thank you for your help.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an OBGYN. She teaches here at the U of I Med School. She has practice in our area. And once a month, she's here on the program. We talk about women's health. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me ask you one further question about breast cancer. And again, this sort of makes the point you did earlier about how, though, that there are so many studies and it's sort of hard to keep up. Yet another study that has to do with, I guess, the possibility that there's some connection between fat consumption and breast cancer. And this is, I just came across it, and it's now there's a piece on the WebMD site about this study that was published in the International Journal of Cancer, and it was another one of these long-term nurse studies where they had groups of nurses that were the
right
study. And it also is retrospective. And it seems a little wacky on the face of it because they found that women were more likely to get breast cancer if, when they were preschoolers, they had regularly eaten French fries. But
well,
then when you think about
nurses,
it, well, you know, fat, I mean, there have been questions raised about, well, could a lot of high consumption of saturated fat, could that have something to do with breast cancer? And I suppose if you ate a lot of fried foods, well, you know, who knows? It may be.
Well, the Nurses' Health Study is a fabulous study, and actually they've started what's called Nurses 2, so they've started mm-hmm. a younger group, and the Nurses' Health Study is a study of women that were enrolled between the ages of 35 and 55. They had something like 120,000 of them, and they essentially send them questionnaires every year, I believe, maybe every other year. I thought it was every year, but regularly at any rate, and they get an absolutely astounding, something outrageous like a 98% response rate from these nurses about just what's going on in their lives. Have you been diagnosed with a heart attack, a breast cancer, or whatever? And they fill out medications they're taking, and then they do studies on this massive database. So it's kind of interesting because the data is prospectively collected, but some of it is, as you say, retrospectively remembered. Mm-hmm. And I believe they came out with a study a few years ago looking at fiber intake and whether or not that had beneficial effects on cancer with this same Nurses' Health Study, and came out with some negative findings. They couldn't see that the fiber was really preventing cancer the way we think that it does, and certainly the kinds of diets that we recommend are to have less fat, more fiber, and maybe that's still good. But in this particular database, they couldn't demonstrate the effectiveness. And I do think that overall fat must have something to do with it. But we also talk about two concepts in medicine. One is a risk factor and one is a risk marker. And a risk factor is something that you definitely know. For instance, we know there are certain cancer-causing HPV viruses that will cause some types of cervical cancer, and that is a risk factor. Mm-hmm. But a risk marker may be something that we know by studies to increase the thing that we're looking at. So, for instance, with cervical cancer, risk marker might be sexual activity. Doesn't mean that you shouldn't have sex and that sex causes cancer, but it does mean that people who have more sex might be more likely to pick up that HPV and so forth. So whether French fries themselves were a risk marker or risk factor is now going to have to be worked out. But fat intake and overall weight is definitely correlated with both many cancers, but including breast cancers.
Yeah. Well, indeed, they did put a fair number of qualifications on this, including the fact that apparently what they did was that they also went to the mom's the nurses' moms. These are grown up women. Yeah. So they went to their mothers and said to them, you know, can you tell us how many French fries your kids ate when they were little? Well, that's asking a lot of anybody to remember what somebody had eaten.
But some of our mothers are more exotic chefs than
maybe
some of us had fairly recurring meal plans.
But I guess though the bottom line, I suppose, is as you say, is there's probably good reason to think that there are a number of good reasons to limit your fat intake. That may or may not be one of them, but you figure,
bottom line is we need a good tasting French fry with a whole lot less fat.
Oh, okay. So you can get some grants and do some research on that.
I bet people are.
To the next caller here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I had a question. I'm getting a bit of advertisements sometimes about thermograms compared with a mammogram, and I wonder what your take is on
that. Not yet. I do think it's one of those studies that's come and gone over the time and that I've been in medicine and since medical school. And definitely there are thermographic findings that are suspicious for cancer, and thermograms can be used for breast cancer screening. And they came out with this little device that I love that was about 15 or, I don't know, 20 years ago, long time ago. And it was just this little disc that you put up on your breast, and it showed areas of heat, and it could be very cheaply applied to large groups of women. It was really nice, but unfortunately wasn't that accurate, and product kind of melted away. And they're working on this. They're working on electrical scans. There's this thing called a T-scan, I think I talked about a while ago, that may be becoming approved as for screening. It's getting very close to approvals for that. And so there are going to be additional technologies that don't expose you to radiation, but not yet.
Thank you. Sorry if I repeated something.
No. Thanks. Thanks for the call. So I guess the idea is here that you would do a scan of the breast, and if you found a hot spot, that would suggest that look at that spot.
Right. Correct. And or get a mammogram. And the other sort of new thing about mammograms is whether or not I think there are going to be some state laws that if a physician orders a mammogram, that your insurance has to pick it up, because women under the age of 35 with high family histories or other suspicious findings that were having mammograms done prior to the typical screening ages were having trouble getting their mammograms paid for. And that's going to be no longer the case.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Piatt County on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question referring back to the bone density. If one is taking Viactive as a supplement, am I correct in assuming that taking two at once, is there something about the body can't absorb more than 500 milligrams of calcium?
When we do studies and actually study things like that, it's really true that there are better ways than others to take your calcium. What I tell people to do is do their best. And I'm a big believer in getting a lot of food and nutrients from your food first. And so what I try to tell my patients to do is figure out approximately how much calcium you get in your diet and then supplement on top of that. And a lot of people can get away with only 500 of in actual supplements because their food actually contains 1,000. But some people can't. And in those, it's better to space it out. But there aren't too many mistakes you can make that are really all that harmful. Calcium is also fairly constipating. And so taking a lot of calcium at once like that can be a little bit difficult, but it's not really harmful. And again, then you want to look at your big picture. If you're getting screened and your bones are healthy, you're probably doing a good job. And if you're getting screened and your bones are losing bone mass, or your urinary tests for bone markers are suspicious, or your blood calcium levels abnormal, your blood vitamin D levels abnormal, then we have to make adjustments. But other than that, probably pretty much whatever you come up with is okay.
Okay, and then real quick, second question. Would you recommend that women over 50 or 55 have a colonoscopy?
At age 50, screening colonoscopies. I still do believe in doing the colon cancer stool tests that you can get once a year in between. Some of the new guidelines show that if you just do your colonoscopy at 50 and then every 10 years, you're doing as well as you can be. Colonoscopy is a fabulous test, and it's been shown to have a lot of benefit, but it still hasn't been around as long to really show the prevention of actual mortality death as some of the other methods, just because it hasn't been studied quite as long. But definitely in terms of picking up cancers, where we can pick them up earlier. So age 50.
Okay, and what was the name of that? That was a colon.
There. You can test the stool for occult blood.
Okay,
and there are different brand names for it, but some doctors do it when they do a rectal exam. Some physicians send you home with card tests. If you're Medicare, you got to do a couple of three card tests to get your Medicare to cover it.
Okay,
but
I would probably get that from my doctor.
Correct.
I mean, it'll be best. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. About 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. This is our monthly show on women's health. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana, where we are. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Back to Aurora here for our caller on line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi. Mm-hmm. I call back again to say that I had heard in the past that the women in Japan have a lower rate of breast cancer, but once they come to America, they fast catch up with the American women.
Well, that is what the studies do show, and exactly why that is, we do tend to attribute it to diet, but it's still not something that we've really been able to prove. And we try to look at other aspects. Are they getting diagnosed with more fibrocystic breast condition? Are they getting more breast pain? Is there some other nutrient with other than soy that is important for them in terms of breast cancer prevention? And exactly what it means in terms of screening. Do they get more tests when they come here? So we pick up more. Are those other factors important? We haven't really teased out, but definitely we have a high rate of breast cancer in the United States. We think that somewhere between 1 in 7 and 1 in 8 women in their lifetime will be diagnosed with breast cancer. So it's something that essentially affects every family. And in fact, I say it like that, but only about 2 out of 10 breast cancers at the most are thought to be due to inherited genetic defects. So other things that we can do to keep our breasts healthy is probably going to be important. And like I was saying to you earlier, those things that we can do to prevent breast cancer, even those women who have 1.5 drinks per day have a higher rate of breast cancer diagnosis.
Drinks of what?
Alcohol. Alcohol.
And what about wine?
Well, you see, and this is an area where physicians need to kind of get themselves together. There was a good article recently, I believe it was in the Journal of the AMA, that talked about these guidelines and when guidelines cross over. And if you're drinking wine for your heart, but is that going to maybe help your heart prevent your breast cancer? But cause you an increased rate of breast cancer? How do you sort out all these competing things? And the answer is that you and your individual physician sit down and really talk about those things that might be at risk before you jump in with a lot of wine for heart disease prevention. Try to figure out what's your cholesterol, what's your cardio-C-reactive protein. This is something that I think I might have talked a little bit in my last show about, and it's something that we're now studying as the potential root cause of a lot of heart disease. And we're studying men over the age of 55 and women over the age of 65 and seeing whether this cardio-C-reactive protein is the ultimate answer. So if you're also being screened for heart disease, what's your urinary protein? What's your blood homocysteine? Have you had a recent, somebody listen to your heart and lungs? There's so many different things. So before you jump right in and self-treat with aspirin or wine or all kinds of other stuff, it's good to sit down with your own healthcare provider and sort it out.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks. We have now, a number of studies that show that soy, having more soy in your diet, can help reduce your risk of heart disease.
Yes. Yes.
Have there been studies that have looked at any potential connection between soy consumption of soy and reducing risk of breast cancer? Have that at least been considered?
Well, there have been, and I haven't read these studies recently, so I don't want to be misquoted, but there's some question as to whether that is good or bad, because soy does have phytoestrogens, and if there are estrogenic causes, there was some theory based on some literally cells in a dish type laboratory work that too many phytoestrogens would actually increase your risk for breast cancer. And I think then more recently they said, but yeah, this couldn't happen at the levels of soy that you should consume to have your overall good food and just good nutrition, I should say. And exactly. You see, the problem is that a lot of my patients say, well, if Asians that have a lot of soy in their diet have low breast cancer, should I start eating this way at age 50? Well, eating that way at age 50 may be a completely different set of physiology than growing up eating that way and eating that way prior to and during the time when you go through your menarche and first go through your maturity. So we haven't sorted it out. Mm-hmm.
Well, it sounds though as if you're saying, again, I don't mean to misquote you, but it sounds as if you're saying that you would have to have a negative effect. You would have to eat an awful lot of soy, maybe more than
maybe than
it's reasonable to assume that someone would.
But the average American soy, I think the average American gets. I think we get in something like 5 grams, whereas the Asian diet, something like 200. Mm-hmm. It's really different.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk with someone here in Champaign. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. On the subject of mammograms, I started getting screening ones fairly early at the age of 36 because of history, but every time I get one, the results come back saying, really, it's too dense to really tell anything. And talking to my OBGYN, she's like, well, you know, if the younger you are, the more dense your breast tissue tends to be. And so then I'm thinking, well, is there, what good is it to keep doing this if really it's going to be very difficult to diagnose mm-hmm. anything?
Well, we usually say with mammograms is that even when they are very difficult to read, that we still do pick up more cancers than if you never got one at all. So that if you have a reason, now for many women, they need a screening, their very first one between age 35 and 40, and then after age 40, start doing them more frequently. So you may be in a situation where you could talk to your primary care provider about doing less frequent intervals during this stage. And you're right that it will be easier to read them as you get older, although many people maintain fibrocystic changes well into their 40s, into their early 50s. Many women who are on hormone replacement therapy will still have fairly dense mammograms. And mammographic density in and of itself is an increased risk factor for diagnosing breast cancer. So we tend to be more vigilant in individuals that have increased density than less.
Okay.
And when they read out these mammograms, another common thing that I get from my patients is they say, well, I had my mammogram, but they call me back. And they call me back for extra views every year, and it drives me crazy. And there was a very good study done, and I think it's been a couple of years ago, but it was done and reported out in the New England Journal of Medicine. And they looked at women participating in mammogram programs over a 10-year period of time, and they calculated that about 1 in 3 women have get called back for these additional studies. So I try to warn my patients, those callbacks, that's part of it.
Okay.
That's part of the whole deal. And still, we think that mammograms are important. And I think that a lot of the research that's really going to benefit us is to prevent these breast cancers in the first place. And I think I've talked about this briefly before, although I heard a lecture since I last mentioned this on the radio show that said it's not coming soon, but they are working on ways that they can do blood tests, just like we screen men for prostate cancer with blood tests. And there are blood tests like that they're working on for for screening for breast cancer, but apparently they're not right around the corner as I had hoped.
Oh, okay. When just a second question, given I am approaching 40, how do you start telling, can you talk about, and I'll hang up, symptoms of menopause and how to kind of see what's going on? I always heard hot flashes or something like that, and every now and then I'm feeling like that. And is this early or?
Most women will have a 2 to 5 year period of time where they'll notice changes, and probably the earliest sign is actually menstrual cycle changes. And for most people, that means that their periods are getting a little bit lighter and they're getting a little bit more close together, which oddly enough translates into getting more regular for some people. But usually you'll notice a menstrual cycle change first, and then hot flashes that occur at night, which wake you up at night, is usually a very early sign as well.
Oh, so it's at night. Okay, so if it's during the day, maybe I'm eating something or drinking something that's causing that.
Well, when we do studies, we just send you home with a diary and we teach you what to track and get you to track it.
Okay.
And so that may be something that you could work out with your healthcare provider.
Okay, great. All right, thanks.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, I think that we're going to have to say that's the time for this time around. I know you came prepared to talk about some other things, but
we didn't get to them all, but that's okay.
We'll save them for next time around.
Absolutely.
Our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen, she is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has private practice here in our area. She's also on the faculty of the U of I Med School. Once a month, on the fourth Monday, she's here, and we talk about women's health, and I guess we'll see you next month. Thank you.
Thanks.